This is the Saxo Market Call, the daily financial markets podcast, across asset classes and around the world.
Hello and welcome to the Saxo Market Call. It's Tuesday, 25th of April, 2023. A market that's limping a little bit lower after the close, but still very lackluster price action. It looks to my mind, I was doing just a visual check. I don't have this statistically confirmed. Just a big caveat there, Peter, because it'd be all over me if I didn't get it statistically confirmed. But the most range-bound sort of bottled up price action we've seen 3.5 weeks-ish here in the S&P since late 2021. The market seems to be at some sort of crossroads. Not sure exactly what it's looking for. I suspect it's to some degree a reading on where the heck we are with this economy. And I think we'll both talk about, Peter, that we're a bit confused on where we are with this economy because there are some conflicting indicators out there. But spooked a bit after the close, to follow up on my original comment, by this First Republic Bank, which, you know, arguably is an idiosyncratic situation since we did see so many other banks reporting where there was not an alarming trend. So, you know, what's the takeaway there? It's not systemic. It's a single story. So, and then we have earnings season really roaring into gear today. So maybe we get something that moves the needle a bit.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see whether First Republic was down 20%. We'll talk a little bit about it later in the podcast, but it's whether it can really rock the futures and the U.S. equity market today. But it potentially will drown because it's a very important earnings day today. There's a lot of things on tap, and we'll, of course, get to that in a couple of minutes. But if you look across the equity market yesterday, I mean, we had the VIX index, John, sliding below 17. Feels very boring, to say the least. We're lacking the next direction, the next some energy in the markets. And the U.S. 10-year yield is just hovering around that 3.5%. It came down a little bit yesterday, and that gave a little bit of a juice, you would imagine, to some of the technology sector, but it didn't. If you look at here on slide two, the global industry groups on one-day performance, you can actually see here that a lot of the semiconductors, the software companies, etc., were down, and the energy stocks, healthcare, communication, which is all the telecommunication operators, and the more consumer staple parts of the economy were actually doing okay. And I think that's an interesting talking point because we'll get back to Nestle's earnings later. But and John, maybe I should just take maybe a little bit random order here because I just want to go to slide four because we've talked about all these earnings releases that have come out yesterday. Over the past couple of weeks, and I wrote yesterday in my update that all these Q1 earnings, they despite a lot of them are beating expectations for Q1 and things look okay. They're all reaffirming their outlook. You can see that these Q1 earnings, they're failing to really lift the earnings outlook for 2023. You can see, I know the numbers are still quite fairly low. I mean, there's only a decline of 1.2% in earnings estimates for earnings in Q2 and Q3, but nevertheless, they're trending down. There was a little bit of uptick when we got the banking earnings, but then we have continued the decline.
Why is the Q4 one so far above Q2 and Q3, which essentially looked like they're just matching? Do you have any...
Yeah, I think it's I've thought that about myself. I thought about it myself, and I think it's potentially, we all know that the economy is slowing down. All the analysts can see that in the numbers, and we'll talk about that on slide three in a few seconds. So maybe it's just the sell side equity analysts being the positive crowd they are. They're just expecting, good times to resume very quickly.
Recessions last 6 months, so we'll mark the next two quarters a bit cautiously, more cautiously, and then maybe keep things where we were further out. Maybe something like that.
Yeah, something like that, because as we have talked about, the expectations for earnings growth from where we are right now into Q4 is almost 7%, which is a very, very high bar, I think, in terms of expectations. But John, I think we need to talk about slide three, and I think it's also interesting for your space, Ole, with commodities, because the U.S. leading indicators that came out yesterday for March, and the year-on-year time series is hitting the lowest levels since the pandemic bottom levels. And if you look at the actual index itself, that's the chart to the left, John. We're nowhere now over a five-year period. And even more importantly, the chart to the right, that's the subcomponent in the U.S. leading indicators focusing on credit conditions. And I've marked in blue line there the credit conditions, and they work as follows. If the higher this time series go, the more the tighter the credit conditions are. So in other words, we have the tightest credit conditions outside the anomaly that was called the pandemic, And then we have to go all the way back to the great financial crisis to see anything that resembles what we're seeing right now. And still, nothing is falling apart.
Yet. No, well, yeah, there's the argument that there was so much liquidity introduced. Everyone got to reset their mortgages at very low levels and is still saving on that because they don't have to refinance. It's only people that net need to buy a new home that are having to pay up due to the higher interest rates. And if you're not confused here on where the economy is, you're not paying attention because there are a lot of confusing data points out there. The surveys suggest in one place they're improving, in another place that they're deteriorating. We get a data point yesterday, like the Dallas Fed manufacturing hitting a, you know, essentially, if you ignore the pandemic, the worst level since 2008 at minus 23.4. That was versus something much better expected, minus 15 or something like that, and also reading similar to the prior month, minus 16 or something. Philly Fed, likewise, worst, essentially the worst data point since the global financial crisis, if you don't consider the pandemic wipeout there briefly in 2020. And we have these, so there's some services, regional services surveys up today as well. These are just surveys. They don't, you know, tell the truth about anything, but they are some kind of indicator, you would think. These have also been quite negative, the one for the Dallas Fed and the one for the Philly Fed, both of which are up today. So yes, confusion reigns, and I was just sent a chart of the home builders, home building stocks, and some of these are posting new highs for the cycle, Peter, when we're supposed to be concerned about a big housing crunch in the U.S. So there's confusion all around. There are some indicators that are pointing to the job market is, the tightness there is receding and receding considerably, but not anything that suggests a material slowdown there. All right. Besides that, let's look at the FX situation because we have the dollar here pinned. If you look at the general measures of the dollar, they're very heavily euro weighted. So when the euro dollar is doing something, it feeds through to the dollar picture. And I would just emphasize that it is the euro doing most of the heavy lifting here as opposed to a general dollar view. And we can see the euro dollar posting 110.50 plus. Did not quite make that high for the cycle overnight, 110.76. I believe is the pip, the level we're looking at here. There's some fairly hawkish in the on balance ECB rhetoric, especially Schnabel saying that a 50 basis point rate hike should be on the table next week. Generally more dovish chief economist Lane also arguing for a rate increase next week, although he refused to say what the size should be. Whereas the more cautious Villeroy of France is saying that we need to be careful about the size and further number of hikes. From here, regardless, the two-year rate differential stretched to a new wide for the cycle, and that is providing some uplift. We still have this debt ceiling concern in the U.S. There's no real update there. I've been talking a lot about that on the last couple of podcasts. There was an article in Politico suggesting that Majority House Whip, so that's the majority leader within the party on the House side for the Republicans, Tom Emmer, is arguing that they should not change this bill that they've proposed and bring it to a vote. Hoping it'll pass. And again, they cannot afford to lose more than four votes. The political article says that there are as many as 12 Republicans that have some problems with this bill. And of course, if five or more say no to it, then that would see this bill failing. I think that could put us on the road to some sort of bipartisan compromise on the debt ceiling. But that is the next key thing to watch on the debt ceiling debate. And I would just note that it's interesting if we're supposed to be concerned about U.S. defaults. So we see a nice strong rally in the U.S. T-bond yesterday, a 30-year Treasury bond rallying. It does not fit with a massive concern about the creditworthiness of the U.S. government. And then we're seeing things like Ola, and we're taking too long to get to you, but we see a weak Aussie once again overnight. These metals prices just not cooperating. Chinese markets having a very ugly session overnight. This China reopening story is just not finding market expression at the moment.
No, it is most certainly a very uneven recovery story that we're getting out from China right now, and the iron ore price is getting close to $100. We got steel production being curbed in China, being reduced, and that's obviously reducing the input for demand for iron ore. So yeah, it's the industrial metal is going through a correction phase here. We also seen the ongoing collapse that we talked about yesterday in lithium, even though some stabilization is starting to emerge there. But just taking a look at the where investors are putting their money in and out of the commodity sector right now, this is the table just highlighting some of the biggest. These are not recommendations. There's obviously a massive amount of ETFs, but these are the biggest, the major ones that where investors are concentrating their efforts. And as you can see, during the past month, when you look at flows, that's the colored the colored column, we can see it's continuing to be gold, gold and silver that's attracting most of the investment demand, but also the broader commodity index. You can see the top one there among the usage eligible ones that we have quite a decent flow coming into broad exposure. So it's not as if the investors are leaving it behind there, but they are just in certain areas quite selective. And you can see the commodities that have been struggling for the past month has really been crude oil. Both Brent and WTI we've seen selling in both ETFs. And it's interesting at a time where obviously OPEC is cutting production, giving that boost to prices last month, but then we had the subsequent sell-off or correction, which is now seem to perhaps to have run its course, but it's just generally the market is looking at this. The market is most certainly overall worried about the economic outlook and what impact it has on fuel demand going forward.
Yeah, I was actually just thinking, because you know, talking about confusing markets, one of the things that I've been the talking points about China for so long is that they started their economic expansion and miracle as an export country, just like they're basically doing the same thing as Japan when they came out of the World War II. And there's always been this talk that to get out of the middle income trap and really advance as a nation, you need to turn into a more consumption driven economy. And you just said, John, you know, where is the China reopening getting expressed? And maybe we've just hit a crossroad. I'm just thinking loud here that China is maybe pivoting towards being more consumption driven, because we have seen in the consumer spending side of things and the luxury stocks in France, also the car makers as well, actually doing quite well in China. So, and we know a lot of European companies and US companies are moving manufacturing out of China. So you could actually have this very weird dynamic that, you know, the Chinese reopening is not as positive for commodities as we thought, because the economy is changing and the geopolitical landscape is not generating the same demand impulse as normally. I'm just thinking out loud here.
You would need to see a big shift in their current account, and that demand would have to show up somewhere. But you know, it's not to say it's not a correct proposition or idea. But let's see where it shows up in the data. It certainly does feel like this is a very different type of stimulus that is going on here and focus than there has been in the past, which has just been on the massive mobilization of, you know, heavy industry, building out infrastructure, massive property developments. These massive property developments, that side of the bubble is, it's about damage control. It's about maybe ensuring some apartments get finished. It's not going to be a whole new cycle of that, is my sense, that the leadership there is just not interested in a new property investment cycle. So yeah, and then that could lead the focus to be more on the consumption side. One thing people will need to consume is food. What a great segue there, huh? Yeah. And we have your chart here on wheat on slide 7, and just an amazing further retreat in prices. Apparently no forward fear, I guess, of the El Nino shift. But what's the focus here? The bears there seem firmly in control.
They are completely in control, and they've been short now for more than, well, almost a year since we peaked last year. The market still fairly quickly started to turn around, and we're now at price levels that are half what we saw around this time last year. It is the continued offloading of massive production in Russia that's weighing on the market, but then we're also starting to get reports in from various corners of the world. Canada is increasing their wheat acreage by 5%. Europe is expecting an above normal harvest this coming season, and the US is going through some problems with its winter wheat conditions. But overall, it's just basically points to some of the major production centers having another bumper year. Again, that could obviously change if we suddenly go without rain for a month, then that will change. But for now, that's what the market is pricing there. They're pricing the wheat on the back of, and that basically just continue to benefit those that have been trading this from the short side for quite a while now.
Yeah, and the winter wheat is planted to grow through the winter and is harvested as soon as May, it looks like.
Indeed, the time.
So yeah, indeed. You can. That's why they can call some of their wheat harvests already now here in late April. All right, let's get back to the equity market. Earnings season barreling into full gear with Microsoft and Alphabet reporting today after the close, Peter. But what's your focus here? And you know, we need to talk a little bit about First Republic, or do we need to even really mention it much?
Yeah, this is a good question. If we start in Europe first, then we have had the earnings this morning from Nestlé and Banco Santander. Nestlé, again, adding to the confusion, right, with the numbers we just talked about, John, and regional surveys, et cetera, et cetera. But here you have a global food giant, organic revenue growth, 9.3% versus 7.3% expected. That's 2 percentage points more. Their pricing power also above expectations, and they're reaffirming their outlook for 2023. So, and this is the thing that confuses me with when you look at the U.S. leading indicators. There is not a single indication yet among all these Q1 earnings releases that the outlook is deteriorating at all. That's not the communication we're getting from companies. So it is just strange. And you have Banco Santander coming out here with Q1 net income beating by 200 million euros for the quarter. Their return on tangible equities, the ROTE, is hitting 14.4% versus 12.4%. This is for a European bank. We just spend a considerable amount of time talking about how bad a lot of European banks are, but Banco Santander is a very well-run bank, and it was driven by very strong net interest income. And I just wonder, I mean, if you look at the results from the U.S. banks and European banks, and I mean, unless we slip into a recession, I wonder whether at one point investor will say, you know, to hell with it, let's just go all in on banks, because it's with the strong performance that they're going to see in their net interest income, regardless of whether there's loan growth or anything, just rolling your balance sheet onto these high interest rates will generate a considerable amount of top line growth and earnings growth for banks. And then First Republic Bank, I agree with you, John. I think it will turn out to be an idiosyncratic risk here, very specifically for this bank. It was on life support. It got a lot. It got 30 billion of deposits as a sort of a handout, if you will, from the and by friends. Well, they are competing, but friends inside the banking industry, the 6 largest or was it 10 largest banks in the U.S. Providing this lifeline. But the bank saw a 41% decline in deposits during Q1. The shares were down 20% in extended trading. They are looking at different strategic options. They are expecting to cut their workforce by 20 to 25% in the current quarter here. So this is a bank that will most likely disappear and go away. Maybe the name will persist and it will just be a subsidiary of another, a bigger bank, but it will not, I think, can continue as, you know, as its own bank. I don't think that's a possibility when you lose almost half of all your deposits.
Yeah. And your earnings slide is quite a number of names now that you've populated it as well with the European names here. You did most of a preview yesterday. Maybe we should just concentrate on today's reports, I suppose.
Yeah, let's do that. Of course, the big names are Microsoft and Alphabet. I wrote a preview. We talked a little bit about it yesterday. I won't go too much into more details. I think the key focus for those two is the cost cutting that both companies have been carrying out over the past 3 to 6 months. So, you know, the investors are certainly looking for the operating income margin to improve for the two technology companies. And then in the primary session, we'll have earnings from Visa, McDonald's, UPS, and G. And I'm highlighting those because they give different angles on the global economy. So UPS, of course, being the global logistics giant, they always talk about the economy. They feel that they have information on the economy that makes them able to make predictions on where the economy is going. So let's see how UPS what they're telling us about the economy. McDonald's, the largest and most global restaurant chain in the world. I think it's always interesting because it tells you how much people, the consumer. Are the consumers willing to spend money on restaurant trips, basically? And GE, global industrial giant, has its fingers into a lot of different industries. And I think it's a very good, will give a very good temperature, I think, reading on the global industrial activity. And then Visa, you know, being the largest payment operator and network in the world, you know, will basically tell us, are consumers spending money, or are they paying for things? And more importantly, What have been the payments volume and start to Q2, because that will of course be reflected in their outlook. So very, very important day today. And then as you can see, John, and with the rest of the week, it's just a monster. And I wrote yesterday, I called it, this is the defining week for the Q1 earnings season. Just Microsoft, Alphabet, Meta tomorrow, and then Amazon on Thursday. Those four companies represent 14% of the S&P 500 alone. And then you can just add the rest there. And I don't know, maybe we have a third or 40% of the meaningful market cap reporting this week.
Wow. And then seeing that Microsoft name, thinking about their investment into ChatGPT, and your comments that you, or the comments that you picked up from Sam Altman, the CEO of OpenAI. I thought just maybe interesting to bring that into this discussion. I think maybe some people's frustration when they use ChatGPT, at least in terms of its awareness of the world, is that there was a cutoff date of, I believe it's September 2021. So it doesn't really have an updated picture of the world beyond that date. And there's a reason for that, that you indicated in his comments on how much it costs to update it, to do a run, basically, to update it to the present. One run costs $100 million. So in other words, if it wanted to be updated week by week, you would have to do a $100 million run. I think it's interesting to consider what the future is. Maybe a couple of comments around that. I think it's really fascinating.
Yes, yeah, so Sam Altman did a speech at MIT around 10, 11 days ago. It was picked up by TechCrunch. And in that speech or conversation, fire chat conversation, if you will, he had some perspectives on these large language models. And he basically said that we're already at some very hard limits on where we can go from here. He was asked specifically, are you working on GPT-5? And he said, no, we're not. And he doesn't believe that the next step forward here in AI systems will be a new large language model that will have twice as many parameters, etc. That's not feasible. He was talking more about, you know, smaller but more higher quality models that could understand specific things, and maybe future AI systems will be sort of a collaborative system that, you know, that works on different subsystems that are smaller and faster to train and understand specific parts of our world. So he said, we're looking for the next idea basically to take us forward from here. And then he said those costs, as you mentioned, it just makes it unfeasible at this point in time. And I think that is actually what is buying Google and Alphabet some time here, that it's too costly relative to the search operation that Google is running.
All right. Let's look at the macro calendar for today, the rest of the week. It's getting a bit busier on that front. We have a two-year treasury auction up today. That could be a focus, although I did note there was some six-month auction yesterday that went fine. So there doesn't seem to be anything affecting the immediate demand for treasuries that are going over this period of the perceived debt ceiling issue. The consumer confidence reading is up today, mostly associated historically as a lagging indicator on the confidence in the labor market. So interesting to see if there's any new direction there. New home sales, again, these smaller surveys that I mentioned, which we're all scratching our heads about the mix of impressions we're getting. An Australian CPI report, important there because it's only a quarterly data point. You get the updated trimmed mean and all these measures could affect the Aussie outlook. And we have a Riksbank meeting up tomorrow. Bank of Japan on Friday, really key there as the dollar yen is trading very nervously in a range. I suspect we may not get a huge new update on the Bank of Japan's plans at this meeting, but we have to be on our toes for that one. All right, that is a wrap for today. It's been a long one, but hopefully a good one. We'll be back tomorrow with the next Saxo Market Call.
Thanks for listening. This has been the Saxo Market Call. For feedback and questions, reach out to us on Twitter at Saxo Market Call or by email, marketcall@saxobank.com.